control all their relations, to decide who does their bidding, who is willing to prostrate and say all hail the President of the United States. Some folks think strong. All the little kids will just leave the playground, move along, thinking in transactions, not about morality. Once again, their steel's no match for humanity. Because no matter how many bombs you drop, however many missiles you hurl, you don't get to run this world.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Thanks to its unlamented outgoing Prime Minister, Britons are now stripped of basic protections from tyranny in the form of laws in place for nearly 1,000 years. While departing, Starmer isn't the only architect of what one British journalist calls a legal architecture of repression. He and Labour built upon and reinforced that repression, now being sprung on both thousands of everyday citizens and the resistance group Palestine Action. Andy Worthington's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Forefathers Band. He is, too, a co-founder of the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at andyworthington.co.uk and at his eponymous Substack site, where I found his recent post, How Were the Filton Four Sentenced for Terrorism When They Weren't Convicted of Terrorism? Welcome back to the program, Andy.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Well, the English legal system gets just more and more interesting by the day. The last time we spoke, it was on the eve of council elections in Britain, though. And then you correctly predicted what would prove that they would prove a disaster for Starmer. Before getting to the court follies, were you surprised by the suddenness of Starmer's still to be finalized departure announcement?
Not really, Chris. I think what we're seeing is that now that they're planning to anoint Andy Burnham as the next leader, presumably without any challenge, they've just been working on how to get that in place since those disastrous election results. Because clearly, there's no way back. I mean, what they don't realise is there's no way back, because it isn't just Starmer. Starmer was just the figurehead. He was a particularly wooden and uncharismatic figurehead. And he personified some of the most horrible things about his administration. I mean, his absolutely unabashed love for Israel and his horrible authoritarianism. But to be honest with you, Chris, that's true of the entire cabinet, just about, of the Labour Party. There's only one person, Ed Miliband, that I think I would make an exception for. These are repellent human beings, frankly. They all sold their souls to get into power with absolutely no principles and no values whatsoever. They all hounded Jeremy Corbyn out of the party. They all tried to destroy the left. They are all in the payroll of, if not the State of Israel, then people working on behalf of the State of Israel. They're all members of the opaque Labour Friends of Israel organization, which won't disclose where it gets its money from. So nothing's going to change. We're just going to get a slightly more pliable, shinier looking figurehead for the same rotten system. And, you know, and the reason I've not disliked Andy Burnham in the past, but for him to be pushed towards the top position now means that they made sure that he knows that he works for Israel, and that he knows that in exchange for power, he'll be required to go along with, well, whatever rubbish the Labour Party thinks that it stands for. He may do, you know, he may do the odd thing to change things, but I'd be very surprised if he'll be fundamentally different on these key issues and whether he can save them at all.
Well, it's no surprise that all the cabinet positions are occupied by orcs. Starmer spent the last 2 years almost placing these people there, you know, and they were and running a purge on the party of all leftists or so-called leftists after he stabbed his friend, as he referred to him, and political mentor Jeremy Corbyn in the back, you know, and you know, A2 Kier. But when you mentioned first of all, it's weird that a party can be so unpopular and yet hold such a huge majority in the House. Usually at this stage where the leader is, you know, ejected, the party has sunk to, you know, horrible levels. But Labour has a huge majority still in the British Parliament. I wonder, though, how is it? There must be amongst all these vipers in under glass that is the new Labour, there must be other aspirant members that aren't going to, you know, the anointment, as you say, of Andy Burnham isn't going to go over well.
Well, I wouldn't have thought so, Chris, because let's face it, all of these people are on £98,000 a year, excluding expenses, and they don't want the gravy train to run out. So I think they'll all be prepared to do whatever it takes. I mean, who these people are, I have no idea in the most cases, because they were, you know, carefully vetted to make sure that they were, you know, aimless, mindless, obedient drones like the rest of the party. There are some exceptions. I mean, I know people who've been to meetings in Parliament about human rights issues and have found a handful of new Labour MPs there who obviously slipped through the net.
God.
But yeah, I mean, it just seems to be complete desperation, even though that's the media are trying their best, not to let anyone know. And as I'm sure you realize as well, they've also managed to erase Gaza from yeah. his record.
Yeah. How unpopular, Andy, is it? I mean, I mentioned how big the majority Labour enjoys is. How is that possible? And these drones, these genetically, it seems, cloned, mindless bots that fill the seats in the House. How do those two elements square with each other?
Well, I don't know, Chris, but like I don't know throughout almost the whole of the West, to be honest. I mean, how is it that, you know, I mean, did you see the recent Pew polling about how Israel is more unpopular than ever amongst, you know, pretty much every country you can think of in the West? And those numbers don't match the politicians' support for Israel at all. So they've essentially, all of these governments that have been supporting Israel, wherever they are up against, I would say, you know, what looks to be 60 to 70% of the population who are actively opposed to what Israel has been doing and therefore to the support of their governments in what's happening. But I've never seen such a big disconnect, I don't think, between the people and the people who are supposed to represent us. I mean, is that not the case that you can see in so many countries of the West?
Well, it certainly is the case here in Canada.
Yeah.
And our prime minister just won a majority, mostly because of the dearth of credible competing parties and competing visions. And he does it much as the way, I think it was Jonathan, the English journalist Jonathan Cook, who... I think it was he who described Starmer's tenure in withering terms, of course, but about having just gone opposite of every one of his stated ambitions to become leader and to become prime minister. Just as our prime minister is in the process of doing right now. I just talked to Eve Engler about Mark Carney, who you may know from banking connections and polo parties with the royal family. But he's following directly in the Starmer path, in the template, I guess the leadership template of promising the moon and delivering puddles. Is it not? I think it's a requirement in this country that there be some at least nominal leadership exercise, you know, even if it's going to be a coronation, they have to kind of go through the process. Is that not the same in Britain?
Yeah, it is. I mean, they will have to be voted for. It's just that it seems unlikely that there'll be any challenges. Although, having said that, you know, I mean, what's always happened in Labour history is that a challenger comes from the left. And, you know, and in 2015, that was the big upset. That was the big surprise when it was either Jeremy Corbyn or John McDonnell. And it was Jeremy Corbyn that year. And suddenly he got the landslide. So, you know, maybe there will be some nominal challenge. But clearly, the entire party machinery is grooming Andy Burnham for this position. Fortunately, the left has been revived massively through the Green Party. So, you know, at least we're not stuck in a position like the United States with only two parties, which are more or less the same. I mean, there are now five parties in the UK. And our system is creaking and breaking under the pressure of all of this, you know, in hopefully interesting ways. I mean, you know, you will realize, Chris, that the important thing is that the far right, the very nakedly fascist far right, who are the most popular party, don't actually win an outright majority because otherwise, I can't imagine how swift the destruction of the United Kingdom will be.
Wow. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. He's also the co-founder of the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees at America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and the Battle of the Beanfield. We're talking in and around his article. We haven't even got to yet. How were the Filton Four sentenced for terrorism when they weren't convicted of terrorism? We've talked, you and I, Andy, a lot about the legal system over there. I kind of trace it. I know it's not particularly correct, but to the Assange fiasco that I know that you were very close to and worked with. Can we take that as a departure point in the end of British justice?
Well, I don't think, in a way, I don't think so, Chris, because that was connected to the US-UK extradition treaty. So the terms of how appallingly he was treated were not really the same as domestic justice. It certainly, you know, revealed the violent heart of the British state, but that's never really been in doubt, has it? I would say the important thing here is, I mean, you know, you mentioned the book that I wrote. I wrote a book about the Battle of the Beanfield, which is the most violent incident of police brutality against unarmed civilians in modern British history, which was 41 years ago. And it led to the introduction of more punitive acts about public order. And they were then succeeded in the 90s when the British people, the young British people, rose up in dissent yet again and started partying all over the countryside with even more punitive laws. And a lot of this can be traced to the Terrorism Act 2000, which was actually amazingly introduced before 9/11, but contained some horrible illiberal changes to the definitions of terrorism, primarily the notion that serious property damage can count as terrorism, flying in the face of what I think we all understand, which is that unless the actions that are being undertaken or the threats of actions involve threat to human life or the taking of human life for this political purpose, then it's not terrorism. Criminal damage is criminal damage. It doesn't get to be terrorism by warping the law to make that the case. But unfortunately, that's never been challenged. So that's been in place since 2000. And that's one of the things that they've been drawing on as they all huddled together to work out how they could turn a direct action group, I mean, a phenomenally successful one, that's why they hated them so much, into a terrorist organization, which they're not. You know, and then the other thing, of course, is the basis of the article that you were mentioning, which is that the people who were convicted, four young people who were convicted of criminal damage, it took a retrial to get there. It took a very biased judge who was doing everything he could to suppress fairness in the trial, were convicted of criminal damage. And then the judge, who had gagged the media and had not told the jury, sentenced them with an additional terrorism connection. And that comes from legislation that was passed just 4 years ago by a woman called Priti Patel, who was a vicious far-right Home Secretary in one of those many Tory governments we had that came and went. And she introduced, she changed the definition of, she changed the possibility of adding increased sentencing, augmented sentencing through a terrorism connection from a handful of very, very grave crimes that it had previously involved, you know, murder and, you know, threats, massive threats to the infrastructure of the country. Deep, deep problematical crimes. She opened it up so that it could be literally anything that carried a 2-year sentence mm-hmm. could be used in an augmented way as interpreted by a judge without consulting anybody as terrorism. And that's what's happened to these four poor young people. In terms of the sentencing, where they've got, you know, between 5 and 8 years, that doesn't look in a way that much more grave than perhaps it could have been. But the problem is they're going to be held in prison as terrorists. They're going to be punitively treated by the prison staff, who will do what they're told. And then they will be haunted for at least 15 years when they are eventually released by a whole load of draconian restrictions on what they can do, because they will be released but convicted terrorists. It is absolutely sickening, Chris. It's really unforgivable and extraordinary that this has happened.
Priti Patel, I call her Pretty Awful Patel, just because it seems fitting. And she looks like one of these Disney evil witch characters. As I alluded in the introduction, that it wasn't just Keir Starmer, that he was building upon the groundwork. And she used some language in bringing forth these expansion of judicial powers. Really, it seemed to me like race baiting and baiting immigrants. And I would think that it would almost be like Rwandan in its scope, enough to be classified as incitement to violence, the way that she described immigrants, both legal and otherwise, to Britain.
Yeah, exactly. And then she was followed by another hugely vile far-right racist of Indian origin, Suella Braverman. Yeah. And between them, I mean, she tied up the kind of loose ends that Priti Patel hadn't managed to drive through. But, I mean, the key point for what's happened in UK politics is that given the opportunity to reverse or stem any of this, the Starmer government didn't. They just built on it. I mean, you know, we have been describing some of the most appalling people in British public life in my lifetime. And yet it took Yvette Cooper of the Labour Party to go even further and prescribe a direct action group as a terrorist organisation. So yet another nail in the coffin of the Labour Party, really. I mean, how can we be looking, Chris, at aspects where they have taken what the far right, I mean, these were far right ministers in these horrible Tory post-Brexit governments, and have become even more far right than that. And yet they're supposed to be the Labour Party.
Well, it's the Liberal Party here, and it's the same thing. The poor Tories in this country are struggling to become further right wing than the government is. It's a classic triangulation where the Liberals like Clinton in the old days and Tony Blair in Britain, they take up the policies of their opposition and leave them no room to attack them.
It's so dismal, isn't it? And in the meantime, you know, in the meantime, a large minority of the population, at least, are sick of it all. Don't want any of this. You know, the drive to the right isn't coming about through public pressure. It's coming about through people listening and caring too much about the horrible opinions of a vocal minority. But it's leaving the decent majority of people completely unrepresented.
Well, now this justice that you mentioned, Justice Jeremy Johnson, he again, this is another guy that looks like he was cast in a movie or maybe yeah. maybe a Pink Floyd video or something as the judge. He's described as biased, slavish, and slavishly devoted defender of the British establishment. His tricks in bringing in this sentence that, as the article alludes, the jurors had no idea. And it's amazing that there still is jurors, because that's another movement that's going on in Britain. They're trying to get rid of jury
votes. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, again, the article is, how were the Filton Four sentenced for terrorism when they weren't convicted of terrorism? How is this possible, Andy, that they can go in there? And what, maybe just what are some of the tricks that Justice Johnson employed to arrive at this, the conclusion that he did, this sentencing?
So what particularly he does is, I mean, there was a lot of suppression of evidence that went on, but the very particular things is that he is adamant that he has the right not to let the jury explain what the motivations for their actions were, as though this was just literally mindless violence. But most crucially, he's seeking to suppress the principle of jury equity, which has been in place since 1670, and, you know, and is not an avoidable part of the law. It's absolutely a requirement that, although at the end of a trial, a judge can say to the jury, I advise you that you should be aware of this, and that you must do this, and that you must do that. That's not an obligation on them. If they believe that the defendants in a case acted because they were motivated through their conscience, then they have the right, the absolute right, to acquit them of what they're charged with. And this is something that, of course, involves protest. You're not going to get a jury acquitting somebody who tries to present a sob story in court about why he went around robbing people's homes. But when you're dealing with political issues and people that are, you know, there's a long history, Chris, of people smashing up arms companies and weapons and planes, not just for use in war, but specifically for use in a genocide. And he's part of a movement that involved also an advisor to the government who straddled conveniently both the Tory and the Labour regimes, who he devoted an entire report really to getting rid of the right of juries to acquit. You know, this is viewed by the far right in politics and in the judiciary as something that shouldn't exist. But and in fact, today it's just been announced that the judge is going after one of the defense lawyers for one of the people in the film.
Yeah, this is Rajiv Menon, who,
yeah, I mean, a hugely respected human rights barrister.
Well, he faced contempt courts proceedings after the first trial, where there was an acquittal of the Palestine Action members charged, because this very thing that he very subtly, and it was something that was reported as a masterclass in tiptoeing language to get around the judge's prescription that he not make the jury aware of their rights in considering guilt or innocence. And everyone said, oh, he did such a masterful job at that, he managed to get by. But then after the fact was charged with contempt, that was thrown out. And now the contempt charges are back.
They are, yeah. And yet, if you know, I mean, I just posted an excerpt from his closing speech in which he, you know, he didn't really tiptoe around it. He said very clearly, the judge has no right to tell you what to do. You are the jury. You can decide whether you want to acquit somebody. And it's not something that the judge has the right to destroy. It's an essential part of settled British law. So, you know, this is how out of control they are, Chris. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Manson, and I just say this because we're in North America, Andy, and so we don't have an appreciation of the deep history that the Europeans take for granted. But in his closing speech the first time around, he cited the so-called Bushell case, if I'm pronouncing that right, a landmark ruling from 1670. Which established the independence of jurors. So here we're going back, you know, nearly 400 years of jurisprudence, and this is the stuff that is being trodden underfoot.
Yeah, and you know, and you can see, obviously, you can see that if you pulled the curtain back, there would be a lot of unsavory people in all kinds of parts of the government, of the establishment, of the judiciary, you know, all people whose dinner party you really wouldn't want to go to, you know, who have obsessed over this for a long time. I mean, this is, you know, this is obviously connected to, yet again, the Labour Party's decision to try to get rid of trial by jury, you know, which they say is just about, you know, a certain number of small and inconvenient, troubling things that are, you know, don't worry about it. But once you start, you know, introducing the notion of removing juries, then, you know, maybe I can hear the jackboots marching in the streets, can't you? It's like, you know, what do the fascists do first? Is they try to disable the independence of the judiciary? Look at what's happening with Donald Trump in the States.
Well, you write that this decision, it contains the monstrous seed of grotesque legal overreach that became evident when the Fulton Four were sentenced. I'm imagining, are they going to end up then, if I mean, they've got right to appeal this decision. Are they going to be held during the course of this appeal as they were the first time? Do you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're undoubtedly imprisoned as we speak, Chris.
Where? Are they going to end up like in where Julian Assange did, in Belmarsh?
Yeah. Well, three of them are women, so they're held in Bronzefield, which is a women's prison. But yes, Samuel Korner is...
He got the heaviest sentence, more than eight years, 8 months, if I remember.
He did. But he's being held in Belmarsh prison with the mass murderers and the terrorists. It's...
The real terrorists.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can draw the Julian Assange analogy quite clearly here. Is a decent people's radar looks at the people that are in Belmarsh and hones in on Julian Assange and goes, what's that guy doing there? Now the people's radar hones in on poor Samuel Korner and goes, hey, what's this guy doing here?
Well, and you've got in your article, and again, it's Howard the Fulton Four sentenced for terrorism when they weren't convicted of terrorism at Andy's site, andyworthington.co.uk. You've got a photograph of the four of them, the Fulton Four sentenced, and they do not look like terrorists. I mean, these people, they look like your neighbors, and they look like kind and caring people
in the extreme. Which is exactly what they are, yeah.
And that's exactly the why they're so dangerous to this regime that you have running England and running its
legal system. And when you see that
system.
As well, Chris, obviously you realize that the whole problem the government had was that they had, this was a massive direct action movement, because all across the country, all kinds of people were deciding that they had to take direct action to disable the weapons, the killing machines being made by an Israeli company on British soil with British support. And why was that? Because what they were being used in was the most horrific thing that any of us have seen in our lifetimes, which is fully supported by our own governments. I mean, that's the reason. And whatever they do, you know, the 3,500 people that they've now arrested for holding up handwritten placards, they're not going to stop. You know, the genie doesn't go back in the bottle. I mean, I'm sure you can see, as I do, Chris, that, you know, they're desperate to try and change the narrative in every way possible throughout the West. They're trying to change the narrative. It's too late. It's finished.
Well, it seems to me that they're stalling for time for Israel to kill as many as possible. We call it talk and log in British Columbia, how the timber industry talks and talks and talks a good game with government while the logging continues. And in this case, the killing continues. I wonder how many people have been killed, maimed, made homeless and orphaned in the course of these trials that have gone on, to see these people thrown into the maw of a clearly unjust legal system. Andy, it's great to talk to you again. We're out of time today. Keep cool over there. It's scorching, the hottest day, you tell me, in British history. And thanks too to Eve Engler. That's all the time I've got, Andy. It's all the time I've got for this week. Until the next time, thanks
Andy. Chris,
because no matter how many bombs you drop, however many missiles you hurl, you don't get to run this world.